This is your Uncle Don coming to you on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia, with the 323rd uplifting edition of my Porcupine Petting Zoo. Now that our May election is behind us, the people of British Columbia, those who pay any attention to the world beyond their narrow lives, are discovering Gordon Campbell's true agenda. Anyone looking behind the electoral propaganda could see that Gordo wasn't showing his hand. Post-election, we're having added consumption taxes dumped onto us.
You're listening to CFUR in Prince George at 88.7 FM, 94.7 cable FM, or online at CFUR.ca.
A big one will be restaurant meals now exempt from PST. I hear promises of some exemptions, but if so, we'll still have a patchwork of two taxes for businesses, negating the supposed advantage of eliminating their paperwork. No mention of such items as postage stamps. Hit them with a whole 12%, it'll cost you 65 cents to send a penny postcard. And they wonder why people use email. Isn't it odd that this hated sales tax will be instituted after the Olympics are over? Would it not have been a better idea to bring in the HST before the party so revenue could be captured to reduce the provincial deficit? With all the money dumped into circulation by governments, we should expect a serious bout of inflation. Economics 101 taught us there's a balance between supply and demand in the worth of money, as in everything else. Money's use lies not in any intrinsic worth, but in its scarcity. Give everyone in the world $1 million, and soon enough prices would compensate, leaving us all with fatter wallets, but total buying power would match the new supply, leaving debtors ahead and savers behind. Economists in power tell us constantly and stridently that inflation is not on the horizon, even with a greater supply of currencies and negative real interest rates. I don't trust them. It seems the economist doth protest too much. There are signs of inflationary bubbles popping up here and there. The price of sugar is about to take off, affecting more than candy. With drought in India and floods in Brazil, world production is down significantly. With ignorance of forethought, governments in major markets have mandated ethanol as an additive in gasoline. Much of this ethanol is derived from sugar. The effect is to exacerbate sugar shortages, raising prices of both food and fuels. Clever, eh? With increased ethanol prices in North America will come added incentive to divert corn from food to fuel, where it is a major feedstock for ethanol. The result? More high food prices. I expect more bubbles like that of sugar popping up and spreading throughout the world economy. As for me, I'm bracing for a huge surge of inflation. If I were a terrorist intent upon spreading worldwide chaos, I'd find a disease for which medical systems are unprepared. I would set my disease loose in a congregation of the maximum number of people from around the planet at a time when it was most virulent. I would expect the disease to incubate amongst the mob, then return with them to their home countries, creating a pandemic. But I needn't lift a finger in this plan, as the governments of British Columbia and Canada are doing the dirty work for me. Next winter, when the flu season is at its peak, they will gather millions from around the planet, jamming them together in stadia to witness jock contests. After having ample opportunity to breathe and cough on each other, these millions will carry swine flu virus to the ends of the earth. And yes, the swine flu fills the bill as a pandemic for which medical systems are unprepared. Vaccines are of dubious value and questionable safety. Those available or to be available may have side effects worse than the disease. With this Olympic venue to incubate swine flu, no matter where you live, visitors will bring this virus to you. You needn't leave the comfort of your home communities to be exposed. Here come the Vancouver Olympics, spreading its benefits well beyond those of us who have to pay for it monetarily. With unexpected cost increases, defaulted sponsorships, and other miscellaneous troubles, not to mention the threat of swine flu, the coming Olympics are in trouble. Along with the cessation of talk of a global war on terror, we witness a severe curtailment of the use of the phrase, "the best games ever." As Vanek cuts frills, begs for free help, and sucks up to governments for money, this fortnight's party will not be as grand as originally planned. They may be able to juggle the books, making the Olympics appear to be a boon to Canada, but hidden costs are enormous. Policing alone is expected to cost $1 billion, up from the original estimate of $175 million. Even at that figure, there will be hidden costs to the public. Vanek may cover basic costs of RCMP salaries, But what of the overtime for those back home filling in for absent members? And increases in crime due to skeleton crews of cops? VANOC may or may not pay salaries of Canada's armed forces, but will there be allowance for wear and tear on their equipment, fuel for aircraft, and other items ultimately to be covered by taxpayers? Have you heard of military operations called Fabric Virgo and Falcon Virgo? These are ongoing exercises by the Canadian and American Air Forces, respectively, to test our defenses against an attack on the Olympics by the Al-Qaeda Air Force. Or didn't you know that Osama bin Laden has the means to bomb the party? Then you haven't been paying attention to the same sources that our governments have. Remember Saddam's weapons of mass destruction? Osama has them now. A mouthpiece for NORAD says one of these planes will be testing our air defenses while both the U.S. and Canada practice intercepting it at high altitude. Spectators will not be able to watch, as these exercises will be too high, but rest assured that Vancouver airspace will be buzzing with fighter planes, many of which will be those of a certain foreign power. Another NORAD dude explained, they'll do a variety of flying exercises in a variety of scenarios to ensure the appropriate level of readiness and safe aerospace for the games. Translation, fly over the lower mainland without permission in February and you're toast. As an aside, this officer assures us that pilots guarding us from the air will wear traditional Air Force uniforms without Olympic insignia. I guess that means no sealskins, as if it makes any difference how pilots are dressed. As we suffer the embarrassment of license plates with the boast, best place on earth, we're driving our economy into the ground with this ill-conceived circus. Good news! Our conservative government announced they will buy 15 giant twin-rotor helicopters for a mere $5 billion of our money. Your share will be $140. This, I suppose, is one of their ways to ameliorate the effects of the recession on working folk. Just in time, thinks you, as our soldiers continue to die from landmines on Afghan roads which we cannot control. Well, that was the plan once upon a time, but the government procurement process is so screwed up that these airships, first considered in 2006, will not begin to arrive until 2013, well after our combat mission is passed. Or will it be? Remember, that date for withdrawal was just a promise. Funny thing, but those helicopters, proposed as troop and supply carriers for the armed forces, have morphed into machines to assist civil authorities in responding to emergencies. Surely they will be useful during floods, earthquakes, forest fires, and of course all those terrorist attacks. But I suspect that this is a fleet in search of an excuse for being. Might it come to pass that Canadian soldiers will still be fighting an intractable war, then in its 12th year, by the time these helicopters are delivered? And might not Stephen Harper plan on this, even as he talks of natural disasters? If this is the plan, then it silently acknowledges that the roads in Afghanistan will still be unsafe for Canadian armored vehicles in 4 years. With $5 billion invested in lumbering aircraft, maybe by that time the Taliban will find a few thousand dollars to put into ground-to-air missiles. Oh, joy. Nigeria, Africa's most populous country, is about half Muslim. Among them is a movement to force the nation to adopt Sharia law, as they're circumventing political niceties to get their way. Attacks by self-styled Taliban have killed 150 of their countrymen so far. What besides religious doctrine drives people anywhere to want such a medieval system of justice? There's a desire for traditional male dominance for one, but I think the greatest asset of Sharia law is that it settles disputes locally, inexpensively, and quickly. Here in Canada, we hear that you get all the justice you can pay for, and there's a strong element of truth in that. In many third world countries, supposedly including Nigeria, this is literally true. You buy your justice. Whoever has the deepest pockets for bribes and lawyers with connections will have favorable judgments. Cases can drag on for years as everyone along the line gets a piece of the action. Canadian delays and expense are the driving forces for the popularity of mediation and voluntary arbitration of disputes. Criminal procedures can last forever and result in a slap on the wrist for the offender and much inconvenience for the aggrieved. A natural outcome of these is an increase in vigilantism. We'd better clean up our civil and criminal justice systems, or we may find more people going to private settlement or violence. The Guardian of Britain predicts that their future government, whether conservative or labor, will have to reduce spending on public services by some 16% between 2011 and 2014. They'll have to do this to rein in a massive growing deficit threatening to collapse their currency. Both parties have promised to increase spending on health, schools, overseas aid, and defense. A defense against whom and what? For these, they will slash such frills as higher education and justice. Justice? That goes back to what I said about increasingly dysfunctional systems. Cut higher education? Just in time for the knowledge-based economy, eh? Meanwhile, they're saddled with huge reductions of taxes on the wealthy brought in by the Iron Lady in her pursuit of pure neoliberal paradise. They're squandering vast amounts on an unwinnable war on behalf of a long-gone American president. They talk of billions for replacements of Trident nuclear missile submarines, machines of massive death without function or targets. I think it's safe to say that any government which does not place the welfare of its people, all of its people, first and foremost in its goals, cannot claim to be a functioning democracy. As we prepare for our 2010 Olympics, Great Britain is gearing up for the 2012 Summer Games. Just the thing to blow public money on while social spending is chopped. If you think our security preparations are over the top, look at Britain's. Still 3 years away, and they're making draconian preparations to control potential protests. They're giving private contractors the right to enter people's homes forcibly to seize and destroy protest placards and related materials. Just think of peacefully sitting at home, having rent-a-cops kick in your door, ransack your house, and destroy anything they find offensive. And Britain was the home of the doctrine, a man's home is his castle. The good news is that Canada's unemployment rate was steady in July. The bad news is that job losses jumped sharply by 45,000. What? As they say, there's lies, damned lies, and statistics. If you give up looking for work, you're not officially unemployed. So a logger in a small northern town who's laid off by his employer is not counted if he knows there are no openings for which he is qualified, anywhere. Knowing there's no work, he must continue to pound the pavements, knocking on the same doors, facing the same humiliating rejections, or he is in limbo, neither employed nor unemployed. Canada's official unemployment rate is 8.6%. If we counted the discouraged, those working at jobs well beneath their skill levels, or unwillingly working only part-time, I suspect the actual rate would be closer to 20%. It seems odd that official rates are kept low, but surely there is reasoning behind that. It might be to assure Canadians that things aren't so bad, so they'll go out and spend, spend, spend. Or perhaps admitting the real rate of unemployment could trigger legal obligations to depressed areas. We see the same thing with official inflation rates. We're given figures for either the complete basket of goods or just the core rate, depending on which is lower. The core rate excludes such things as food and fuel because, supposedly, they fluctuate too wildly. Housing costs are calculated only on monthly payments, not actual prices, so we get an unreal picture there. Remember, when you see or hear that word percent, look out. You're probably in for a ride. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Stephen Harper met a vexed Felipe Calderon at the Three Amigos Summit. Something about precipitously requiring visas for our NAFTA partner citizens when they visit Canada. Felipe is angry. Our leader took full responsibility for this slap at our partner, saying it's the fault of our lax refugee admission system. Mea culpa, says he. Well, who has been at the helm of our new government of Canada for years? Who refused to fill vacancies on the refugee board until very recently, causing a massive backlog of cases? And who, pray tell, has the ability to put forth legislation correcting flaws in our current system? It's not enough to admit responsibility for a problem if you don't do something to correct it. I never thought of myself as anti-Semitic. I don't know how many Jews I know as the subject of religion seldom comes up. I make it clear that I'm bereft of any superstitions, organized or otherwise, so it's not an issue. People can believe what they want and bear the consequences as long as they don't impinge upon me. I came within an ace of working on a kibbutz in Israel and would have if my parents had been gracious enough to forward a letter from Israel while I was traveling. Now I find that I'm classed as anti-Semitic because I criticize the state of Israel. not Jews per se, but the country plunked uninvited into Palestinian land in the wake of World War II. Europe did the Jews a nasty during Hitler's regime, and Palestine was made to pay for it. Israel is touted as a shining light in the Middle East, a beacon of freedom amongst the despotisms of their neighbors. Israel is a democracy in the same fashion that apartheid South Africa was. Not all of its citizens are equal in the law. Israel has declared itself a Jewish state, and non-Jews live as second-class citizens. The Anglican Church made a tactical error in considering a resolution condemning Israel for its racist policies and advocating a boycott. This brought down the full force and vigor of the Canadian Jewish Congress, which holds the State of Israel and all of its actions to be beyond the pale of criticism. Pressure has been such that the Anglican Church was forced to recant. Israel is the homeland to which any Jew can claim instant citizenship as soon as setting foot on its sacred soil. This right is somewhat clouded by the state's refusal to allow any Palestinians, driven away by terror tactics, to return to their homes. Sorry, they belong to others now. The State of Israel is supported so wholeheartedly by the United States that it embarrasses many Americans. They cannot understand why displaced Palestinians have no residual rights to the land from which they were evicted, while Cubans who left voluntarily after their revolution are supposed to possess an inalienable right to reclaim lands and property they abandoned in 1959. Let me be clear. I have admiration for Jews. The high school I attended and the university from which I graduated had a preponderance of Jews. They were mostly hard-working while others were playing. Many have achieved success through drive, although they've had their bad apples like any group. Bernie Madoff is not typical. But I have nothing but contempt for Israel's Slavish supporters, be they Jews or Christians. Time has long passed when anyone should be saying, "My country, right or wrong." I have a novel way of disposing of dead fluorescent tubes. There's an abandoned oil tank on our property with a hole near the top into which I slide them. My grandson saw me do this the other day and asked why. I explained that these tubes contain mercury and isolating it in the tank will keep it out of the environment for hundreds of years. "Then what?" he asked. "Then it won't matter because there'll be no one to harm." Out came my pessimism about the fate of the human race. This was inexplicable to an 11-year-old. From his perspective, people have always been here and always will be. That's an easy belief to hold if you're ignorant of facts and trends. To wit, the human race has ballooned from a few hundred million over 6.5 billion in a matter of several hundred years. It's estimated that Earth could support no more than a couple of hundred million sustainably, and only if distributed optimally. We're not reducing our numbers, predicted to reach 9 billion this century. We're exhausting natural resources at an increasing rate. The most accessible ores have been mined, and half our petroleum's been burned. We're destroying our farmlands with intensive chemical agriculture. We've polluted major rivers to the point where their contents are barely recognized as water. We've built an interdependent world economy demanding growth in use of these resources. By no stretch of the imagination can we call our use of this planet sustainable. Third world slum cities are petri dishes for disease, even as we find our antibiotics unable to deal with them. With airlines whisking people between countries, an outbreak of a new disease can spread universally in days. We're ripe for pandemics that will make swine flu insignificant. We're destroying our atmosphere and changing our climate, even as rabid apologists for the status quo deny the fact. With our world divided among 200 independent nation-states, none wants to be in the forefront of meaningful amelioration at the expense of losing competitive advantage to its neighbors. In just decades, we have become hopelessly dependent on computers and the Internet. The world economy is tied to bits and bytes. These are, in turn, dependent on a steady, reliable flow of electricity. With such grand innovations as plug-in electric autos, we have no idea where and how the added power will be generated. British Columbia's leaders are staking the future on private run-of-the-river micro-hydro plants. Do we have enough reliable potential power there to charge a million automobile batteries overnight? Can we burn enough oil, gas, and coal to make up the shortage, even if those are available? Capitalism demands constant growth, and we cannot tolerate contraction or even a steady state. It expands or collapses, a fact that has proven itself in the last 2 years. contraction of complex interlocked systems is not orderly, but chaotic and devastating. One of these fine days we'll hit the wall in any of several ways, and the repercussions can barely be imagined. Most people, like my grandson, cannot envision drastic, wrenching changes to their lifestyles. Our thinking leads us to project the past into the future in a linear manner. There was gas at the corner station yesterday, and it will be there tomorrow. Yesterday I threw a switch and the lights went on. It'll work tomorrow. We swiped the credit card and money appears today. Tomorrow, who knows? The same with the existence of hospitals, food in the grocery store, money in the bank. It ain't necessarily so, and we're unprepared for a cascading collapse which could undermine all of our assumptions. The maddening thing is that our political and corporate leaders are aware of all these pending disasters with their multiple potential triggers, but nothing serious is being done to prepare us for a chaotic future. Politicians look no further than the next election. Corporation executives look to the next quarter's profit and their bonuses. When it all hits the fan, none will be prepared. Their bank accounts and gated communities will not shield them from wrenching dislocations. Nations are already warring over access to resources. Americans fight for oil in Iraq. Israel suppresses Palestinians for water. If Canada didn't have such a bunch of spineless leaders, we'd resist the coming demand of the U.S. for our water, which could inspire them to take it by force. Fortunately, we would be saved from any such by yielding to the greater power, as we always do. Do I sound pessimistic or realistic? And is there any difference anymore? I hesitate to criticize President Obama for fear that of the company that I would be keeping. He stepped on some powerful toes in his quest to save the economy and make needed reforms. Many of those toes are on the feet of the despicable. The medical pharmaceutical advertising complex and its tied-in insurance industry, which I hesitate to call a system, is hugely profitable even in its inefficiency. They, together with their purchased politicians, lobbyists, and radio show loudmouths, no laughter please, are doing a masterful job of snowing the American public. The lies and vitriol they spread about perceived evil in a single-payer medical system have eclipsed the voices of reason. Whatever reforms emerge from Obama's White House compromises will be cosmetic and the powerful will not be unseated. Okay, that battle over Medicare is well known, but other reforms have been less publicized. More Obama enemies have been created by his proposal to change a law on the books for 137 years, allowing companies to take minerals, except for oil and coal, from public lands without paying royalties. What could be more reasonable in a time of trillion-dollar deficits than to collect a cut for taking valuable resources belonging to the people? What could be better calculated to alienate powerful corporations who profit greatly from this legalized theft? Every reform, good or bad, harms some vested interest. Unfortunately, Obama came to power facing such a massive pile of problems, many the result of decades of right-wing destruction, that dealing with all of them at once is in danger of alienating a majority of the citizens. They may benefit from a half dozen reforms, but remember the one that affects their little world negatively. There's much to criticize in Obama's administration, but I hesitate to join the howling mob of clowns crying for his head. Thank gods for religion. If it weren't for faith, where would we be? We would be at each other's throats, and morality would be non-existent. Well, that's the theory. Now let me refer to a few items from the 7 August edition of The Guardian Weekly. Item: President Karzai is on track to win another election as the head of Afghanistan's puppet government. This is the guy who backtracked on a promise to revoke a law allowing rape within marriage, based on a 14th-century-old religious doctrine. Item: in Pakistan, 6 Christians were burned alive by rampaging Muslims, responding to a rumor that someone had desecrated the pages of a religious book, a paper book, one of a billion identical books in print. In Wisconsin, U.S. of A., a man was found guilty of second-degree reckless homicide for praying over his 11-year-old diabetic daughter instead of seeking medical care. He said, "If I go to the doctor, I'm putting the doctor before God." I have some advice for this guy in jail. He'd better put his fellow prisoners and guards' rules before his God's will, or he's in for a rough time. Item: Italy has finally joined the rest of Europe in approving an abortion pill over the strenuous objections of a certain bunch of celibate men living in an insular Italian city of 900 inhabitants. Welcome to the 21st century. Item, the United States is debating whether their constitutional separation of church and state prohibits the use of public money to support religious organizations overseas. In the argument, it came to light that during the Russian occupation, the U.S. gave support to an Afghan journal promoting militant jihad. Did someone say blowback? Item, the elected president of Iran, selected from a list of candidates pre-approved by a group of religious men, had to kiss the shoulder of their grand poobah Ayatollah before he could take office. Here in Canada, candidates kiss a different part of their corporate master's anatomy for approval. Members of a militant Nigerian sect ran amok in four states, killing at least 700 innocent civilians. Their leader, believed to be invincible and immortal, was taken into custody and died of lead poisoning under mysterious circumstances. Item, religious incitement is considered the motive for an Israeli man who burst into a gay youth center, killing two and injuring 11 with gunfire. Item, Great Britain's highest court has finally granted a woman's husband the right to travel with her to seek assisted suicide overseas. Formerly would have been subject to prosecution under British law, inspired by Christian principles. Item, Christian conservatives in the United States continue to fight sex education in the schools based on their interpretation of another old religious book. As a result, teenage pregnancies are on the rise while gonorrhea and syphilis rebound in their young. Hispanic girls in the U.S. have three times the children of non-Hispanics, largely due to their religion prohibiting contraception. A correlation was discovered whereby 9 of the 10 states with the highest teen birth rates are the ones where Bush's religion-inspired abstinence campaigns were the most enthusiastically supported. Item, Nicaragua's President Daniel Ortega was a hero to his people when I visited there in 1986. As leader of the Sandinista Revolution, he was a champion of secular and gender equality, even in a country that was nominally 96% Roman Catholic. His revolution was overthrown by Ronald Reagan's mercenary Contra armies and right-wing government of the rich restored. Only recently has Ortega won the presidency again, but at what a price. He bowed to religious know-nothings by approving a law prohibiting abortion in all cases with no exceptions. Forget victims of rape, incest, or pregnancies with no chance of producing a viable human, even if the mother's life is in danger. Abortion is, according to the author of a report on Nicaragua for Amnesty International, quote, a trigger issue for the religious lobby. The human rights of half the population were considered expendable in a feverish election, close quote. The foregoing were culled from one weekly edition of The Guardian Weekly. This concludes the 323rd edition of my Porcupine Petting Zoo. Sleep tight, compadres.